This is Katie Gillespie, and this is a talk that I gave at the Decolonizing Cascadia Critical Geographies mini conference in Vancouver, British Columbia on November 17th, 2012. It's titled Replacing the Quote Unquote Dairy Cow, Decolonizing the Animal Body. This talk is really about a question. I'm just in the process of completing my dissertation fieldwork on the lives of cows in the Pacific Northwest dairy industry. This presentation is heavy on empirics since I've just collected my empirical data and I am now moving into ways of making sense of it. In other words, I'm starting to take stock and explore what kind of theoretical lens or lenses will be the most fruitful for understanding the life course of the dairy cow in the food industry. My question is this: are discourses of colonization and decolonization a useful analytic for what I've seen? I'm not arguing that this is a useful analytic or that it's not useful analytic. I'm trying to put this question out there, and I'm hoping you all can help me to think through this. During the fieldwork for my dissertation on the dairy industry in the Pacific Northwest, I attended a number of livestock auctions in Washington State where cows, pigs, goats, sheep, and horses are sold and bought. Originally, this space was a peripheral part of my research, just one of the spaces, one stop along the life course of bovine animals in the dairy industry. And yet this space has become integral for understanding the experience of the quote-unquote dairy cow and the hierarchical relationship between humans and farmed animals more broadly. This is both because of difficulties accessing dairy farms and other private industry spaces, livestock auctions are open to the public, and also because there is something noteworthy about the auction itself. Each livestock auction is a little different, but there are general characteristics that are familiar in each of the ones I attended. They are usually held in large buildings with a series of pens and chutes for containing the animals while they wait before or after the sale. The auction itself takes place in a hall with bleachers for buyers and spectators, a large ring with doors large enough to herd large animals through, and an elevated seat for the auctioneer. The animal is herded into the ring and the bidding begins. Animals are either auctioned off by the head, per whole animal, or by the pound, usually per 100 pounds of weight. The bidding is generally finished in less than a minute, and the animal is herded out an exit door where he or she steps onto a scale that displays the weight on a screen above the auctioneer. This calculates the total cost of the animal. The livestock auction is a space where the commodification of the animal body is visible and obvious. It is, after all, the site where animals are bought and sold in a highly efficient auction system. The animals are spray-painted at the auction with symbols to indicate certain characteristics, whether an animal is sterile, whether a cow is pregnant, and so on. Animals come to the auction in all conditions, and their value is set depending on that condition. A great number of spent dairy cows are sent to auction and are bought by meat buyers who send them to slaughter. Some are emaciated, their bones jutting out, and others dragging on the ground, red with mastitis. Often these cows don't sell. Many are in better shape, their bodies looking more robust and selling for competitive prices. Some are sold as replacement cows for dairy herds. Some are pregnant and sold with the promise of the impending birth of a calf. Some are sold with their offspring as a cow-calf pair, and some calves are sold alone. Male cows born into the dairy industry have little economic value and are usually either slaughtered a few days after birth for cheap meat, or they are sold to a veal producer the day or two after their birth. These day-old calves are tiny and thin, enter the auction pen with their umbilical cords still attached, and sell for as little as $15 if they sell at all. Using the theme of this year's Decolonizing Cascadia as inspiration, I am interested in experimenting with the use of the colonization and decolonization of the animal body as a potential analytic for this research. Breeze Harper's work on critical food geographies and post-colonial and critical race theories emphasizes the ways in which places and human beings have been historically colonized through imperialist practices and the ways in which these colonizing practices are employed today in spaces of commodity production near and far, the meat, egg, and dairy industries, the sugar, coffee, and tobacco industries. In addition to thinking about the impacts of production on the workers laboring in these industries, Harper explores the intersecting impacts of the consumption of these commodities on our own bodies. In particular, she outlines the ways in which consumption of meat, dairy, sugar, caffeine, and tobacco reproduce histories of exploitation of non-white bodies and those living in poverty, the exploitation of the environment and non-human bodies, and urges us all to engage in a project of decolonizing our own bodies through a radical rethinking of our consumption practices. Harper writes, "We must extend our anti-racist and anti-poverty beliefs to all people, non-human animals, and Mother Gaia." Thinking about the space of the individual body as a site of colonization, I'm interested in testing the potential for extending this kind of analysis to non-human bodies. Legal scholars like David Favor, Gary Francione, and also Bob Torres have explored the ways in which the status of animals as property creates and maintains certain conditions for them. And indeed, the dairy cow is a prime example of how this property status enables the breeding, birthing, raising, and milking, and eventual slaughter of the cow for commodity production. Through this breeding, milking, feeding, and reproductive technology, and the overall appropriation of the biological and reproductive capabilities of the animal, the quote-unquote dairy cow is constructed as a producer of commodities and as a commodity herself. She is specifically purposed for this production, and the name Dairy Cow reflects this co-optation of her life and body. She is not just a cow, but a dairy cow, and her life is not her own. Holsteins and Jersey breed cattle are the two most commonly used breeds in the United States and Canada. These breeds have been developed carefully to select for certain characteristics, and in the meticulous construction of the dairy cow, milk quality, quantity, fertility, temperament, etc. When a female calf is born in the dairy industry, she is typically removed from her mother the day after birth. She may be moved to another area on the farm or to a different farm entirely, where she is raised in a calf hutch and automatically bottle fed until she can eat solid foods. She is kept separate from the other calves for fear of cross-contamination, transfer of diseases, and competition in feeding until she is weaned at 6 to 8 weeks of age. After weaning, she's moved to a group hutch where she is housed with other calves. At this time, she may have her tail docked, though some farmers choose to wait until a few weeks before her first calving. Feeding is increasingly automated, and automatic feeding machines can scan the calf's identifying tag so that a computer system can track that each calf has eaten. If a calf does not eat, the farmer will know to check on that animal. Various identification methods are employed for dairy cattle. Common methods include hot iron or freeze branding, ear tags, neck chains or ropes, electronic transmitters. In various ways, these identifying marks are written on the body of the cow in permanent and less permanent ways. Every step of the biological and reproductive process is overseen and maintained by the humans involved in the care of the animal. Heifers are typically impregnated for the first time through artificial insemination at approximately 15 months of age. The overwhelming majority of reproduction is done through artificial insemination, and bulls are kept on separate breeding farms for semen production, whereby they are routinely ejaculated by hand or by machine, called electro-ejaculation, after which the semen is frozen and sold all over the country and sometimes internationally to dairy farms. Bulls are valued for their physical qualities, their genetic heritage, and the quality and virility of their semen. Like humans, cows have a gestation period of 9 months and will give birth for the first time at 24 months. Dairy cows in the Pacific Northwest are impregnated and give birth once each year. After giving birth for the first time, the calf is removed and the cow is moved into the milking string where she is milked by machine approximately 3 times a day. This process is almost entirely automated, with a human farmer overseeing the process. 3 months after giving birth, cows are impregnated again and milked throughout their pregnancy until 60 days before giving birth, which is called the drying off period. Thus, cows in the dairy industry are milked for approximately 300 days out of every year. This human-controlled cycle of artificial insemination, pregnancy, birth, and milking places enormous strain on the body of the cow, and usually after only 3 or 4 years, though sometimes longer, her productivity declines, she produces less milk, and she may not become pregnant as reliably. The economic pressures on farmers and the dairy industry and the low cost of milk require careful calculation on the part of the farmer to determine the fine line of productivity and profitability of each individual animal. When the cost of feeding and maintaining the cow outweighs her profitability as a milk producer, she is sold to slaughter for lower quality processed and ground beef. The connections between thinking about the appropriation, exploitation, and violation of gendered bodies in particular should not be ignored here, though a gendered analysis is beyond the scope of this particular talk. Gendered violence has long been a feature of colonization. The devices that hold the animals still for artificial insemination are colloquially called the rape rack, and the discourse surrounding artificial insemination has many other overt and implicit undertones of sexual violence toward the animal, but this is a subject for another talk. The auction, then, ultimately becomes a space where much of the animal's history of commodification and human involvement in that history can be read on the landscape of the cow's body in a visceral way. This history of human appropriation of that body space for labor, commodity extraction, and ultimately the fleshly body itself is written in the brands on the hip of each cow, the bones visible just beneath the taut skin, the docked tails, the ear tags, the udders pushed beyond capacity, the spray paint on the animal's hides indicating certain less visible characteristics, and the barcodes scannable at the point of sale. Citing Derek Jensen, Breeze Harper writes, quote, "American society is a continuum of colonialism and imperialism driven by the collective addition of material acquisition. These materials are usually stolen, then extracted from the land as a natural resource, then drastically altered into a controlled, artificial, and addictive product, perpetuating a life-killing imperial ideology we call civilization," end quote. Food is at the heart of society. In very material ways, it is what fuels and feeds us. And yet, in ways that Harper explores, the very foods we eat also either reproduce or resist colonizing influences on the body and on other bodies near and far. Animals, for Harper, are an integral part of the colonial diet, and contemporary industrialized animal agriculture is another layer of colonizing and other. In an effort to resist using decolonization simply as a metaphor, as Eve Tuck and Wayne Yang warn against, I want to look carefully at the possibility that the institution of increasingly industrialized animal agriculture may have material ties to thinking about colonial and neocolonial practices and the implications of these practices moving forward. From the violent appropriation of indigenous land and bodies by settlers in regions like the Pacific Northwest, to the changing landscape of these regions for urbanization, industrialization, and intensifying agricultural production, colonial traces persist, and in addition to remaining in these direct ways, may be reinscribed also by the environmental destruction, land appropriation, and the extension of control over other kinds of bodies. Indeed, there are those scholars like Graham Huggan and Helen Tiffin who argue that human liberation struggles will never reach their full potential for change without reimagining our relationships of hierarchy with other species and living ecosystems. And so, as I'm just beginning the process of thinking through these ideas in relation to my own fieldwork, I'm interested in exploring the following questions and would welcome your feedback and suggestions moving forward. In what material ways are human-animal relations imbued with colonial imaginaries? Is the analytic of colonization useful and/or appropriate for thinking through the extension of the appropriation of lives and bodies beyond the realm of human? If so, how might we think about our own role in decolonizing the animal body? Finally, using the dairy cow as an example, what might it look like to replace these ingrained hierarchies in which humans are often situated in relations of power and violence against non-human lives and bodies? Thank you.